You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T-minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T-minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for 220K.
T-minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T-minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2,
1. Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Control room, you're on here.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Leno Sanic. Today we're speaking to noted researcher, author Jim DiEugenio. Hello, Jim.
Good evening, Len. How's the weather up there in Vancouver?
It's been sunny. It's been hot. Today was cool, but I don't know. You know, August, the summer is supposed to be hot. I don't know if it's too hot for people, but I like a nice sunny day. So.
Well, it's too hot down here.
Oh, well. Well, you're welcome to come up here. Come on up to Vancouver. Spend a week here or something.
Well, you've had some eventful shows. You had Gary Aguilar on.
Yeah.
You had Jeff Carter.
Right.
About his new film on Fletcher.
Yeah.
Which is going to premiere up there very soon.
Yeah.
Okay. And Jeff sent me a screener. So I'll be reviewing it at Kennedy's and King. Now, I don't know if we've talked. James Lawson passed away. James Lawson was an assistant, an advisor to Martin Luther King. Okay. An expert in nonviolence. Very, very interested in how King was assassinated and very knowledgeable about that. He was located in Los Angeles. Now, finally, Monica Wiesack, who wrote probably the best book about John F. Kennedy since Jim Douglas, was interviewed by Jeff Sachs, the historian from Columbia. And he's an economist, not a historian. But he's very interested in the John Kennedy case. And he gets a lot of exposure. And Monica was on his show, and we have a link to that interview. Remember, she wrote the book, America's Last President, a very good book about the Kennedy presidency. If you haven't read it, please do. And please take a look at this fine interview, okay, with Jeff Sachs. I have a lot of admiration for Jeff Sachs because he's one of the very, very few academics who will go out on a limb to say what he really thinks, even if it means he's not going to be in the mainstream media. So that's very interesting to look at. Now, what I want to talk about tonight is the newest article that we have up at Kennedy's and King. It's called Maureen Callahan Goes Over the Edge Along with Megyn Kelly. Okay, what's this about? It's in two parts. It's going to eventually be three. How to begin with this? As people know, a long, long, long time ago, back in the late 1990s, I did an essay which became famous. It's called The Posthumous Assassination of John F. Kennedy. I did that upon the occasion of Seymour Hersh's book being published, The Dark Side of Camelot. Now, that, of course, is one of the very worst books ever written about Kennedy. There's no other way to say it. It was a hatchet job. And it blew up in his face even before it was published. Peter Jennings was stupid enough, and ABC was stupid enough to buy the TV broadcast rights to it. And they got egg all over their face because of the Lex Cusack scandal, which was supposed to be a trust between Joseph Kennedy, John Kennedy, and Marilyn Monroe. She would not reveal his mob ties. or their affair in return for her funding her mother's hospitalization because she was institutionalized. And that any idiot could have told you that was a pile of manure, but Hirsch believed it. And it wasn't until ABC bought the rights that they had the documents forensically tested. And they ended up, as anybody could have figured out, they ended up being false. All right. Now, what's so interesting about that is that I know that two sources told Hirsch that the documents looked phony to them. One was Joseph Kennedy's secretary, who was the last person who was still alive at that time. She said, A, that's not my signature. And second, I never met Marilyn Monroe. And according to this document, I would have had to meet Marilyn Monroe. And Greg Schreiner, who runs the Marilyn Monroe fan club up here, and who I visited on one or two occasions when I was doing that article, he told me Hirsch came to see him. And he took one look at that signature and said, that's not Marilyn's signature. So in other words, Hirsch was warned in advance about this, but it didn't matter to him. And finally, ABC brought it to paper and ink authorities, professionals, and typewriter authorities and professionals. And they all know these are fraudulent documents. Okay? All right? Well, this book, which is called Ask Not, by this Maureen Callahan, is the same type of a book. All right? It's a hatchet job, except it's a different type of hatchet job in that it tries to take in the whole Kennedy family and concentrates on their alleged treatment of females. All right. Now, I want to say one thing because we're not going to get to part three tonight. Okay. But this is an issue I'm going to deal with in part three. This book was going nowhere until Megyn Kelly gave Callahan, I think, an hour on her podcast. Okay. Three people got in contact with me and they said, Jim, this is hideous. Okay. I mean, it's just horrible. I hope you do something about this. And so this is when I decided, okay, I have to increase my anxiety and read this piece of junk book. Okay. You know, and the front of the book has three sets of eyes. Okay. They are in order: Marilyn Monroe, Jacqueline Kennedy, and Carolyn Bessette. Okay. All right. Now, this is essentially how I start the review. Okay. How anybody in this day and age could fall for the idea that there was something going on between the Kennedy brothers and Marilyn Monroe, which caused her premature death, is just crazy. Okay. I mean, it's been discredited beyond belief. Okay. And I've done it both on the website and on this show. And you've had on a guy who I believe is one of the most honest and one of the most well-read experts on that case, which, of course, is Don McGovern. All right. I think you've had him two or three times. We've had him on. Okay. And he wrote a book called Murder Orthodoxies. And then he transferred that book to a website. All right. I read I think it's about 500 pages, okay, and I read the whole book, and I reviewed it, all right, and then he transferred it to his website. I think it's Marilyn from the 22nd Row, I think is the name of it, his website, all right, and all you have to do is read his book, and you'll understand what a hoax the whole Marilyn Monroe industry was and is, all right. Now, there's also Gary Vitaco Robles, who wrote an even longer book called Icon, which I also read. That book is, I think, twice as long as Dawn's because it's in two volumes, all right? It's about 1,000 pages long. There's also a person named April Vivea who has a very good website called Classic Blondes. And she's done a lot of good work on this subject. All right. Now, when I saw that Maureen Callahan had sourced the books of Tony Summers and Donald Wolfe, okay, I was ready to give up on the book already. All right. Because both of those guys lend credibility to a proven BS artist and con man named Robert Schlatzer, all right? And we've talked about this guy, all right? And both these guys, that is Donald Wolfe and Summers, referenced this con artist literally dozens of times in their books, all right? And this is really important to understand because it shows you what Callahan will stoop to in order to go ahead and smear these guys. All right. Schlatzer made up this BS story about being married to Marilyn Monroe in Mexico. Don McGovern spent 18 pages in his book tearing this thing apart, shred by shred, piece by piece, all right? It was literally made up of whole cloth. It simply will not withstand the light of day. But then April Vivea found a picture of Marilyn in L.A. the night that she was supposed to be in Tijuana marrying Schlatzer, okay? Then Donald Spoto found a check that she wrote that was on the day she was supposed to be married, except the check was signed in Beverly Hills, all right? So this is simply, this whole thing is a charade, a fake, okay, which nobody should even source those books anymore because both those guys, and by the way, how bad was Schlatzer? He actually bribed a friend of his, boxer, actor, noble kid Giselle, to say that he was a witness at the wedding. And then after Schlatzer promised to give him money, he welched on the bribe, okay? And if you can believe it, Summers used noble kid Giselle in order to validate Schlatzer. All right. Now, some of the other people that I think we've talked about before, like Bernie Spindel, the wiretap expert for Jimmy Hoffa, private investigator Fred Otash, who actually hired a high, well, he wanted to hire a high-priced hooker, okay, to go ahead and approach John F. Kennedy. She wouldn't go along with it. I mean, if you have lower morals than a street girl, then it doesn't say very much for you, does it? Okay. Spindel went to jail for illegal wiretapping, okay. And then there's a trick golfer, Gene Carmen, okay? And by the way, and Callahan uses Gene Carmen quite a lot in this junk book, all right? Now, Gene Carmen was probably the female version of Robert Schlatzer. She made a career out of being Marilyn's so-called best girlfriend, all right, even though nobody can find her in any of Marilyn's address books, and none of her friends ever remember Gene Carmen being around, all right? And Gene Carmen made a career out of this because she made 31, let me say that again, 31 TV appearances on these cheap jack talk shows masquerading as Marilyn's best girlfriend. 31, unbelievable. All right. Okay. Now, Callahan also says that Monroe's house was bugged. Gary Vitaco Robles did a very good job on this. Her house was not bugged, and he actually got the phone records from a very long time ago. Also, she says that somehow the LAPD concealed her phone records at her house. Gary found out that the initial LAPD investigation actually did have the phone records. Okay. All right. And there was nothing funny about them. Every call that went to the Department of Justice went through the main switchboard. Okay. And she was talking to Bobby Kennedy about her problem with the studio who fired her from her last film. And it turned out that Bobby Kennedy knew the chairman of the board at Fox, okay? And Gary proves this in his book, that this was, in all probability, the reason for that, all right? Now, the second LAPD inquiry, the Ron Carroll inquiry, went even further because they tried to find every phone that Monroe could have possibly used in the last few months of her life. All right. And again, there was nothing suspicious about any of this stuff. All right. Now, then there's also, you know, Callahan uses every piece of proven BS in the book. All right. The idea that there was some kind of a diary that missing after her death. Okay. Which has also been proven to be wrong. There was an address book in her bedroom. She did not have a conventional diary. What she had was a journal that was written on a legal pad. And this was recovered by her business manager. I think her name was Inez Nelson, from her belongings that were in storage. And then these were then published in a book called Fragments. And guess what? There's nothing like what Gene Carmen and Robert Slasher says was supposed to be in there is in there. None of it is in there. To give you an example of how bad Slatzer is, Slatzer actually begins his book, which I think was called The Life and Curious Death of Marilyn Monroe, by saying Monroe was reading her diary to him. In that supposed diary, it says that Bobby Kennedy was running the Bay of Pigs for his brother. I mean, come on. This should make anybody a little sick, all right? Anybody who knows anything about the Bay of Pigs will understand that Bobby Kennedy had little or nothing to do with that operation. It only happened something like 3 months after Kennedy was inaugurated and was a total CIA operation. All right. Bobby Kennedy was not in on that. All right. So there was nothing to say. I mean, as everybody knows, and as Fletcher Prouty made famous, that Bobby Kennedy was in on the investigation of the Bay of Pigs, called the Taylor Commission in the White House, all right? But he had little or nothing to do with the actual Bay of Pigs operation. That was run by Alan Dulles, by Charles Cabell, and Dick Bissell. So this is just pure bunk, all right? Now, credible authors like Don McGovern and Randy Turabelli and Gary Vitaco Robles have all chronicled the meetings. Oh, also Donna Morrell. Donna Morrell is a very good researcher from San Diego. The meetings between both Marilyn and Bobby Kennedy and Marilyn and JFK. Now, give me a break. You know, I think the best numbers I've seen are that there were three times from 1961 to 1963 that JFK met with Monroe. They were in the same building or house or estate or whatever. There were three or four times that she met with Bobby Kennedy. The ones with Bobby Kennedy were all in public with at least one other person there. So this idea that somehow, and by the way, Callahan goes over Niagara Falls on this. She tries to suggest that Marilyn had an abortion in 1963, and it was probably Bobby Kennedy's child. which, as I point out in my review, is just about flatly impossible. All right, because A, Thomas Noguchi found no evidence of any recent abortion when he did the autopsy, and her gynecologist, Leon Cron, said she never did have one. So this is more garbage, okay? And why she throws it in there, you know, I don't understand, but it's part of her agenda on this trashy book. All right, now, she closes, or comes close to closing, by saying that on the day Monroe passed away, both Bobby Kennedy and Peter Lawford were at her house. Oh, my God. I was ready to throw up when I read that. All right. First of all, Bobby Kennedy was nowhere near Brentwood on that day. He was 350 miles north in this town called Gilroy, which is around San Francisco. And this is proven by a series of pictures. There's, I think, 10 photographs in Susan Bernard's book, Marilyn Intimate Exposures. Okay. There's the pictures from the morning till dusk, and it's matched by testimony. Now, anybody who knows anything about court procedure will tell you that those photographs and that testimony would be allowed in a court of law, okay? Because if you have the person taking the picture and you have the testimony certifying, okay, that he was taking the picture and he was there, then that's court approved. Thus, Gene Carmen was a dirty, rotten liar. All right? And Maureen Callahan should have never trusted her. Now, as per Lawford, again, the evidence is overwhelming that he was not at Marilyn's home that day. Okay? He had invited her to a dinner party at his house in Santa Monica. Okay? The guests were talent manager Gary Durgin and TV producer Joe Nahr and his wife, Dolores. She begged off because she said she was tired. But Lawford was worried because he thought she was speaking in a slurred speech pattern, and he was aware of her drug problem. He called back, could not get through, and he telephoned his agent, Milton Ebbins, and told him to call Monroe's lawyer, Milton Rudin. This got through to Marilyn's housekeeper, Eunice Murray, who said that she was all right. Eunice Murray didn't know about the Lawford phone call previously. Lawford still wanted to go over and get her. But Milton Ebbins, his agent, told him not to. Okay, because Eunice Murray would say the same thing. She was tired and in the bedroom. Ebbins later revealed that he had a secret agenda. He knew about Monroe's drug problem, and he knew how bad it would look if the president's brother-in-law, Peter Lawford, his client, was at her house when the paramedics arrived with an ambulance. Okay. He later said that Lawford never even mentioned Bobby Kennedy that evening, or even after he told him that she had passed on. Okay. The relationship, as Randy Turabelli, who did a pretty good biography of Marilyn, said, the relationship between Bobby Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe was something that was, you know, purely friendship. It was a platonic kind of thing, okay? There was never anything going on between the two. And anybody who says that there was, like Callahan uses Jeannie Martin, Dean Martin's former wife, is simply wrong, okay? Jeannie Martin is a wild outlier on this issue. It's not even known if she was there when Bobby was at Peter Lawford's house, because one of the times he did go there was with his wife. All right. Finally, the famous San Francisco pathologist, Boyd Stevens, did a review of the autopsy for Ronald Carroll. That was 1982 in the second investigation. He said that the drugs that Monroe took were ingested, not injected. In other words, she swallowed them, okay? They were not injected into her body like all these murder theories, you know, want us to believe. Cyril Weck, before he passed away, also looked at the autopsy. And he was on a show hosted by Gary Vitaco Robles. He agreed with Boyd Stevens. So in other words, you have Thomas Noguchi, you have Boyd Stevens, you have Cyril Weck. Okay? I think they take precedence over Maureen Callahan and also Gene Carmen. Okay? All right. I mean, Gene Carmen actually once said that Johnny Roselli killed Sam Giancana over Marilyn Monroe. All right, come on, please. This was 13 years after Monroe died, and Johnny was in retirement in Florida. Okay, please, give me a break. I've rarely seen so much, you know, rubbish in a relatively short place. Okay, but those set of eyes about Marilyn should not be on the cover of that book. Okay, because there was nothing to do with it. All right. Now, the second set of eyes belongs to Jackie Kennedy. I was startled. I really was. Why? Because anybody who reads any decent biography of Jackie Kennedy, and there is two or three of them that are out there, all right, would know that before she married John F. Kennedy, she was working for $42.50 a week at a newspaper called the Washington Times Herald, doing man on the street interviews as a photojournalist. All right, that's about translates to about $650 a week today. So in other words, she was making less than $3,000 a month. Okay. And then that paper was bought by the Washington Post and discontinued. Now, after JFK was killed, Jackie Kennedy had a trust fund that in today's dollars was worth $2 million a year. She then borrowed money from Bobby Kennedy to buy a home in Georgetown, which is a very Tony suburb of Washington, D.C. She sold that and leveraged it into a 14-room townhouse on Fifth Avenue in New York City, across the street from Central Park. And according to Bobby Kennedy, she never paid him back the money. Now, here's the punchline. In 2006, that townhouse sold for $30 million. So how anybody can say that Jackie Kennedy was somehow perniciously influenced. I mean, come on, please, give me a break. All right. And in my opinion, she deserved it. She deserved all that money. Okay. You know why? Jackie Kennedy revolutionized the office of the First Lady. All right. I don't think there's any question about that. She took it to a point that I believe went even beyond Eleanor Roosevelt, all right? As her stepbrother once said, being the First Lady wasn't just her job. It was literally who she was, all right? The woman spoke five languages. So whenever Kennedy would go to a foreign country, like France, Italy, or in Central America, South America, she would speak either Spanish, French, or Italian. Okay. She was very well read. She was bright. She helped him on a lot of his political ideas in the Senate when he was formulating a philosophy. All right. On, for example, atomic weapons. All right. She helped him translate essays and books from the French and the Spanish to write his great Algeria speech in 1957. And these policies carried over to when JFK became president. All right? At Kennedy's very last cabinet meeting, he mentioned the word poverty six times. Jackie Kennedy took the notes of that meeting and he gave them to Bobby Kennedy. And she gave them to Bobby Kennedy. RFK then had them framed and put up on his wall. All right. She was also very cognizant of what he was trying to do with the Alliance for Progress. If you remember, in Monica Wiesack's book, when the newspaper reporters pictured her visit to an orphanage in Venezuela and wrote how she allowed the children to kiss her when she left, they both despised that kind of reporting because it indicated what an inferiority complex American foreign policy had given South America, all right? When she visited Cambodia in 1967, Prince Sihanouk had written a speech to greet her, which in its original form said the Vietnam War would not have happened if JFK had lived, all right? There's the famous story of when Robert McNamara had dinner with Jackie, and I believe it was 1967. She was well aware of the fact that Johnson had completely altered Kennedy's Indochina policy. She used to actually visit wounded veterans in hospitals. That night, while reading a poem which reminded of her husband, she grew very tense, could barely talk, and then she suddenly exploded, all right? And she began to pound him across his chest, screaming at him that he'd do something to stop the slaughter. So this is what I mean. Jackie Kennedy was worth every dollar that she got because she was that good of a first lady, all right? Now, here's my question. Well, see if you can find any of this in Callahan's book. And by the way, I haven't even mentioned her tour, her famous tour of the White House. I haven't even mentioned how she became a fashion plate. Okay? All right? This is all outside of that stuff. All right? Now, what does Maureen Callahan give us instead? Well, she uses a book by, I hope you're sitting down, and I hope you haven't eaten anything, okay, by the late David Heyman, all right, which, again, like Gene Carmen, how any respectable writer can use David Heyman in this day and age is really shocking to me, okay? I mean, many, many people, including Donna Morrell, David K. Johnston, and Donald McGovern have all proven, okay, that, to put it lightly, David Heyman was a complete fraud as a writer, okay? And in this review, I put down my reasons proving that the guy was a fraud. The other book that she uses is a book by Peter Evans called Nemesis, okay? And Lisa Peace read that book. She thinks that Nemesis very possibly could be a black book inspired by the late Robert Mayhew. So if these are the kind of sources that you use and you ignore all the other stuff, then please, okay? And she also uses Kitty Kelly. Kitty Kelly. I'm not kidding. All right, I wish I was. David Heyman, Peter Evans, Kitty Kelly. All right. All right. Now, she also says, I don't even want to go into this, what she says happened at Parkland Hospital. It's one of the most disgusting things I've ever read in the literature. And I've read a lot of bad stuff, but I don't want to talk about it here. So you read the review and you'll find out what she does. Okay. She also tries to imply that Jackie kept her suit on after Kennedy's murder because she said there's a difference between drama and histrionics. That isn't the reason she said that. What Jackie did, she wiped off the blood on her face and her husband's hair that was also in her face. She wiped that off because she thought that was too much. That should to be shown to the public. Okay? That's why she did that. That's why she said that. All right. Now, Jackie Kennedy, for a very good reason, became the most famous first lady in history. You know, a worldwide political symbol, a fashion icon, and ultimately a millionaire due to her wedding to John F. Kennedy. So there's a second dud for Maureen Callahan. All right, now the third one, the third set of eyes are Carolyn Bessette, okay? And that, of course, ended up being John Kennedy Jr.'s girlfriend and wife, okay? Now, she tries to demean John F. Kennedy Jr. So I did a little brush up on John F. Kennedy Jr. All right. Some of this stuff I really didn't know very well. See, John F. Kennedy Jr. went to Brown University for his undergraduate degree. And he sponsored organized seminars on apartheid in South Africa. Since he had visited the country and he was pretty much horrified by the stuff going on down there. He then worked a year at the Office of Business Development in New York, the director of the 42nd Street Development Corporation in 1986. All right. He was trying to bring real estate development into certain areas of New York City. He did that for $20,000 a year. He then headed up a nonprofit group called Reaching Up, which, among other things, provided education and other opportunities for workers who aided disabled persons. Now, that's clearly an influence from Bobby Kennedy and his sister, Eunice Shriver. Eunice Shriver founded the Special Olympics. All right. He then went to New York University Law School, passed the bar on his third try, which, by the way, is not at all unusual. Okay. All right. And he stayed in the Manhattan's DA's office for 4 years. And according to the people who worked with him, he took cases nobody else would take. And then he won them. All right? All right. We, of course, know what later happened. He started George Magazine, or his political culture magazine. And Jackie Kennedy really didn't want him to do that. She actually wanted him to stay in the legal profession because she thought he would have been very, very good at it. All right. Now, for Callahan to somehow demean what John F. Kennedy did, Jr. did for George Magazine, I mean, really, that magazine had a 500,000 circulation in 1995. Now, why is that exceptional? Because this was about the time when the online revolution was taking place. For a point of comparison, David Talbot started Salon that same year. Salon peaked at 100,000 subscribers, about 20% of what George had. And remember, George was a paper magazine, much more difficult to sell than an online magazine. So for her to say, which she does, by the way, that John Kennedy Jr. was a middle-aged man with no accomplishments, I mean, that's just ridiculous, okay? She even criticizes the wedding of John F. Kennedy Jr. to Carolyn Bessette, which took place off the coast of Georgia on Cumberland Island. So I had to go ahead and look this up in a book about Carolyn Bessette, from what this woman wrote, 10 pages. I think her name was Beller, okay? Elizabeth Beller, all right? She wrote, and it was a joyous occasion. People were singing, they were dancing, they were reciting poetry, all right? And by the way, it took place at something called the First African Baptist Church. And that was to honor JFK's and RFK's work on civil rights. They tricked the media by saying that the wedding was going to be in Ireland, okay, which it was not, all right? And so this is how they managed to dodge the paparazzi, okay? There was only a select guest list. I think there were 50 people there. And there was only one phone at the inn that they rented, all right? All right, now, one of the worst parts of Callahan's book, she leaves the impression that Carolyn was going to be buried separately from her husband. So she writes at the end of a chapter, quote, in death as in life, they never considered Carolyn Bessette a real Kennedy. I wrote in my notes, I said, look this one up, which I did. And anyone can look up burial of John F. Kennedy Jr. online, and you'll see that all three people who died in that crash, which was him, her, and her sister, were buried at sea. All right. Then there were two commemorations, one on the 23rd and one on the July 23rd, one on July 24th. Okay, in which no cameras were allowed. At that one, the first one where 315 people were invited. Okay. And then the last one was in Greenwich. All right. How on earth she could write what she did in the face of all this evidence is just unbelievable. Now, I'm sure you're aware, and I'm sure all of our listeners are aware, there was an unbelievable outpouring of grief exhibited outside John F. Kennedy Jr.'s townhouse when the news came in that all three bodies had been recovered. I mean, people were bringing gifts, bringing flowers, and this went on for days. Doing a little bit of research on this, I don't know if you know this, there's two things I discovered. John F. Kennedy Jr. was going to run for governor of New York in 2002. And some people say that that was going to be his stepping stone to running for president. But here's something that I didn't know at all. And I want to ask you if you knew this. Did you know that he was a student of his father's assassination? Did you know that, Len?
I had heard that he'd been talking to a couple of researchers. I don't know how much, but I had heard that.
Well, I got in contact with John Jeffries, and he found an old girlfriend of John F. Kennedy Jr. And her name was Meg Azzoni. And I'm going to quote what she said, because I thought this was shocking. You know, his heartfelt quest was to expose and bring to trial those who killed his father and who covered it up. Then Don got corroboration on this from a second source who wouldn't let him use his name. But the gist of it was that John Jr. was keenly interested in and knowledgeable about his father's assassination and often talked about it privately, unquote. I didn't know this at all. I was really surprised when I discovered this. And according to Steve Gallon, who was a friend of John Kennedy Jr.'s, he told Gallon that, quote, Bobby knew everything. And Gallon didn't follow that up. Can you believe this? I mean, I would have grabbed him by the neck and go, what do you mean? How do you know Bobby knew everything? You know? All right. So when I learned this stuff, see, I had never studied. Have you? Have you ever studied that crash?
Well, you know, I'd say I just started looking into it and it became uncomfortable for me that I went, oh shit, another one. There's so many anomalies. You just start to go, is there a fuse missing from the flight data recorder?
That's what I read.
Yeah. You know, so you start going, oh, they killed him too.
Well, In the very little, but yeah, I deliberately avoided that case. I figure, you know, look, I can't look into every single one of these things. So let me read something that I found out through Don Jeffries. Okay. The official story was that it was hazy weather. But the last message that they have from John Kennedy Jr. was the conditions were all well. And the man assigned to write the FAA report, Edward Meyer, strongly disagreed with the weather conditions being depicted as hazy. And you can read about this on Don Jeffries' Substack, okay, of 7/18/24. He's done a lot of really good work on this case. Again, I mean, I he was going to run for governor, and that was going to be the stepping stone to his run for the presidency. His heartfelt quest was to expose and bring to trial those who killed his father and who covered it up. He said to Gillon that Bobby knew everything. And then his last message is all was well. And the guy who wrote the FA report strongly disagreed. I mean, this is enough to drive you mad. Okay. So I can see why you didn't want to look into it, Len. Okay. All right. So this is how I concluded. Those people gathered outside the townhouse understood something that Callahan's country mile agenda cannot bring herself to address. This tragedy deprived them of their hope for another JFK and Jackie. So that's, you know, like I said, I'm not an expert on that case at all, you know, but I was really, really stunned when I learned this stuff. I mean, when I read that he was a student of the JFK case and then he was reading all these books and he told this thing to his old girlfriend, I mean, that was like getting a slap across the face, you know, really, really, really kind of shocking. And he then tells Gillon that Bobby knew everything. Holy Christ. You know? I mean, this is really, really bizarre. But anyway, those are the three sets of eyes that she puts on the cover of this book. Marilyn Monroe, who, as I said, the Kennedys had nothing to do with anything about her perishing. Okay. Jackie Bouvier Kennedy, who, if you ask me, did pretty darn well, okay, as a result of her marriage to John F. Kennedy. And Carolyn Bessett, who she completely ignores any of these questions that I have managed to put in to this review. You know, why? I you know, very, very, very puzzling. Now, also in this book, in part two, which I won't go into tonight, it's too much for one evening. All right. She discusses, oh my God, I can't believe this. First Jean Carmen, then Mimi Alford. And she actually discusses Mimi Alford in the Missile Crisis, if you can believe it. Yeah. She also gets in there Leo Damore, the late Leo Damore in Chappaquiddick, and also Dominic Dunn and Mark Furman on the whole Michael Skakel case. So here's my question. If you continually use these kind of sources, what do you think you're going to come up with? I'll tell you what you're going to come up with. You're going to come up with every cheap smear and pernicious rumor, okay, very little of it resembling facts that you can put in a book. All right. Look, very briefly, let me go to Mimi Alford and the Missile Crisis. As Randy Tirabelli proves in his book about Jackie Kennedy, Jackie Kennedy, first of all, refused to go to a bunker. Clint Hill wanted her to go to a bomb shelter in the East Wing. She refused to go. The reason she refused to go, she goes, look, the average citizen in the United States does not have that privilege. And I should not have any other privilege than they should have. So she refused to go. She also refused to leave the White House. Okay? All right? She said, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die with my husband and my children. She was gone for exactly 2 days out of the 15, I think it was 14 days. And those 2 days she was gone, her husband was gone. And when he returned, he called her up and said she should come back to the White House. Now, what do you think he was doing there? Do you think he wanted to introduce Mimi Alford to his wife? Please. Okay. Mimi Alford also was a woman who said that JFK said words to the effect that something like better red than dead. I mean, please, come on. Come on. How can you keep a straight face reading this stuff? All right. Kennedy goes on national television and he warns the Russians that any missile launched from Cuba would be considered an attack from Russia and it would be retaliated for. All right. He considered the secret installation of a first strike for, and by the way, that's what it was. There was a first strike in Cuba. All right. If you take a look, if you add up all the three arms of the triad that the Russians had placed in Cuba, all right, and by that I mean the intercontinental ballistic missiles, number one, the submarines, number two, and the bombers, number three, okay, and I'm even leaving out the tactical nukes, okay, that this was a first strike that they had assembled. They could literally hit almost any city in the United States, except for the Pacific Northwest, the continental United States. And so Kennedy said, look, I think they're going to make a play for Berlin. I think that's what he's going to confront me with. All right. And Kennedy's, that was one place in the world. Kennedy was ready to let go of Vietnam. We all know that. But Berlin was a different story. All right. We already saw the year before the Berlin crisis. All right. Kennedy was very clear that he thought the Atlantic Alliance could be rolled up if they took Berlin. All right. All right. In his meeting with the Joint Chiefs, this is what he said. What if the Russians make a play for Berlin? All right. And so that's where he drew the line in the sand. All right. Now, this is why he proposed, but he had the Joint Chiefs put together this incredible, huge, multi-military operation designed for land, sea, and air operations against Cuba. It's called O-Plan 316. And thank God him and Khrushchev came to an agreement, because that would have been incinerated because the Russians had given Castro two sets of tactical nuclear weapons, one short range, about 25 to 30 miles, and one long range, about 90 miles. And that would have incinerated, okay, any amphibious invasion, you know, of Cuba. And God knows where on earth that would have. So when Mimi Alford says, better, please, better, give me a break, will you? All right. See it's always been one of the objectives of the right wing to somehow take away Kennedy's masterful performance in the missile crisis. And simply because it was so terrific. All right. He was so judicious. He was so visionary. He was asking questions way ahead of what everybody else was thinking. All right. He would challenge them with these questions and they wouldn't be able to give him a good answer. Like, for example, when the proposal was to bomb the missile silos. All right. He said, can you be sure that no civilians will be killed? And they said, well, no, we can't be certain that no civilians will be killed if we blow up the missile silos. All right. And so then he would say, okay, what's a worst case scenario? How many civilians do you think could perish if we did something like that? What if we took out every single missile silo? You know, every single missile silo with a jet fighter. What is the worst case scenario? And they said about 15,000. And so that was off the board. That was too much, you know, for Kennedy. All right. And so that's one of the reasons why he then went ahead and backed up McNamara on the blockade. Okay. Because that would be a way for him to give the other side negotiating room. Right. All right. And so thank God that they decided this was a way that we can settle this thing. And the settlement, of course, was that the Russians would remove the first strike, and Kennedy made a pledge not to invade Cuba. Okay? All right. And that was those were roughly the outlines of the deal. Okay? And so this was a absolutely I left out one of the most important parts. See, by this time, Kennedy didn't trust his advisors. You know, maybe Shoup, maybe McNamara, but hardly anyone else. And so this is why he used his brother to go to the Russian embassy. Okay? And they more or less, Bobby Kennedy essentially told him, the Russian ambassador, that, you know, we have to come to a solution to this thing. I don't know how much longer my brother can keep these military guys on the straight and narrow. Okay? You know, and so they essentially hashed out this agreement. And so this is really how it came to a solution. And this was really, I mean, if you take a look what, for example, Johnson was saying when Kennedy asked him for his opinion, all right, Johnson was not happy with this, okay? And but he was never happy with it because he thought the United States was giving up too much, you know, in the deal, all right? If you take a look at the Joint Chiefs, I mean, these guys were nuts. All right. They really didn't give, you know, 2 cents about all the fatalities, the casualties that could have happened if we really did go to a nuclear war. So as many people like Fred Kaplan has said, you know, if anything, Kennedy doesn't get enough credit for what he did during the missile crisis. And so this is why people like Mimi Alford and Maureen Callahan, okay, like doing this kind of stuff, okay, because it was really, I think Kennedy did a great job during the missile crisis. I don't think there's any question about that. And we might not be here tonight if he would not have been in the executive chair. Okay, that's a distinct possibility we wouldn't be here, all right? But I still think that what he did with Vietnam was really his crowning achievement, okay? Which, of course, was reversed by Johnson. But what he did there was really magnificent, okay? Staring down everybody else and doing it for as long as he did, and refusing to bring combat troops in, you know, and withdrawing all the advisors, considering what happened there, which we now know, you got about 3.8 million dead in Vietnam. You got about 2 million in Cambodia. Okay, and by the way, those are the latest figures. Okay, those are the latest figures. And I think those are the most accurate figures because the there was a study by a British medical group that knocked on doors in Vietnam. And they sat down and did in-house interviews. And they didn't just ask how many people died during the war. They also asked, did anybody die by stepping on a landmine later? Okay. And that's how they came up with that 3.8 million figure. And then if you add in the 2 million for the genocide by Pol Pot, you know, in Cambodia, that's when you come up with this figure of 5.8 million. All right. And so this was what Kennedy was trying to save us from. Okay. So if you put those two achievements on a scale, all right, you can either say like one is a little bigger, one of the other, but I think they more or less even out each other. Kennedy saved us from three wars. Cuba twice, okay, Laos in 1961, and then Vietnam in 1963. Okay, those were three places that everybody wanted to go to war in, and Kennedy managed to stay out of all three. Okay, now in the part three of this review, which I'm writing right now, see, whenever I read a book like this, and it's the same thing with Cy Hirsch's book. If you really analyze the book, what it really is underneath all this rubbish, it's really a political book, okay? Cy Hirsch's book was really a political book, if you ask me. And I'm going to reveal in part three the indications that this is what the agenda was. Like, for example, you know what he says about the missile crisis? That this was a dilemma of his own making. Give me a break. It was the Russians who moved in a first strike, deliberately going against what Kennedy requested. He told the Russians, defensive weapons, fine. No offensive weapons in Cuba. All right. Then he brought in the Russian foreign minister when the U-2s got the pictures. And he asked him right across his desk, are there offensive weapons in Cuba? And he lied, okay? All right? And this is when Kennedy decided, well, I'm going to have to go on TV and warn these guys because I don't think they believe me, all right? And so that's what happened. There were, I think ultimately, the best numbers I've seen, there were over 100 ICBMs in Cuba, all right? And there were, I think, six atomic submarines, all right? And there were, I think, 13 jet fighters. So that was more than enough for a first strike, depending on how you targeted them. And so Kennedy had no choice but to do what he did. So when she says it was a dilemma, what is she talking about? Okay. I mean, does she really think we're all a bunch of idiots? You know, well, I'm sorry. There's some people who've read up on this stuff, and we're not idiots. Okay. And for Megyn Kelly to endorse this book on her podcast, because it was really Megyn Kelly, the book was going nowhere until she gave Sullivan an hour. Okay. Excuse me, Callahan, an hour on her show. All right, and I'm going to talk about that in the part three of this review. All right. Okay, so anyway, let me close by saying we still need Kennedys and King is still in need of a webmaster. I haven't been on lately, but if anybody has a qualifications to do the HTML, John Kellen is filling in for us on a temporary basis. Okay, if you can please get in contact with Len or me, I would very much appreciate that. Okay, if you can do it. All right, it really doesn't take all that much time. Okay, and it's for a great cause. Okay, Len, are you going on the road again?
Not in the near future, but yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay, so you get a kick out of entertaining?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay. You look like you're having a great time.
Yeah, we've got I think in November, 10 dates in Mexico.
You're going down to Mexico?
Yeah.
You got a gig for 10 days?
No. Three in one city, two in another city, and all over the place, right? Yeah.
Oh, okay. Where in Mexico?
Cabo, I think.
Cabo San Lucas?
Yeah.
You mean in Baja?
Yeah. We were there last time we played Mexicali, Tijuana, and Ensenada.
Hey, let me know, and I can be down there. I love going to Baja.
Really?
Yeah, I love Baja, California.
Okay, as soon as I got the dates and the times and dates, I'll let you know. Yeah.
All right. Great. Okay.
All right. Well,
Man.
Thanks so much. And
you're welcome.
We'll talk to you in the next week or two, and keep in touch via email. And
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
You want me to do some letters?
No. Let's do that. Let's just do that. Like, this
All
is
right.
already like an hour 10 minutes. So
okay, fine.
Yeah, for next week.
And, okay.
Yeah. Good. So, thanks so much for making time, and keep the letters coming in, and we answer them here.
Okay. Have a good night, partner.
All right. You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Good night.